imprisoned energy is now held captive in virtually all atoms where astral matter clogs the orbital passages provided for the revolution of electrons. This astral matter, man-created, cannot be destroyed under universal law. It can only be transmuted by the violet fire acting upon it under the divine laws of mercy, compassion and forgiveness. The seventh ray is also known as the ray of white magic because of its instantaneous alchemical action of transmutation. The transmuted energy, freed by divine forgiveness, is usually so weakened by its brutal imprisonment that it must be carried by the angelic kingdom back to the sun for recharging. In recent years, since the fission fusion boys have roamed the earth, seeking to destroy, the situation has become extremely serious. And that is one reason why hundreds of spaceships regularly fly through the atmosphere, transmuting vast areas of atomic infection. Beginning in 1957, tens of millions of angels began moving earthward in shining legions. The angels serve throughout the galaxy wherever they are accepted. Only a minimum number have remained in the Earth's contaminated atmosphere during the past centuries because they were rejected by the majority of people who could no longer see them. However, by 1957 the calls for angelic assistance had become so urgent that under the direction of the seven great archangels, each serving on one of the seven rays, millions upon millions of angels moved into the etheric regions around the earth to stand in readiness to answer any calls. The cherubim are particularly active now, and very often their flights through the night skies are observed and they are mistaken for space ships. The cherubim fly in large groups, in V formation, and as they fly within their own force field they give off a brilliant white light. The return of the angels to the Earth's atmosphere will have a profound effect on the planet as a whole, because no other planet in the system attempts to operate without the aid of angels, with at least five to every member of the human population. Only the arrogant humanity of Earth has rejected angelic assistance. Now under the jurisdiction of Saint Germain, Shun of the Violet Fire, the angels are being encouraged to return to help mankind. Ascended Master Saint Germain has also supervised the selection of thousands of volunteers from other planets who have been infiltrating into the Earth's population in large numbers during the past 100 years. Of course, certain individuals from other planets have been coming to the Earth since the days of Sanat Kumara's regime. But during the past 100 years more than 10 million volunteers have either embodied here in Earth families, or have been brought in as babies and reared as Earth children. Within the past decade the space people have used the moon as a space station, and have built tremendous installations there in which adults from other planets are conditioned to live in a simulated Earth atmosphere, and then landed here in spaceships. These people mingle freely with the population, live as Earth people do, and are seldom recognized as interplanetary visitors. During the past 100 years, Ascended Master Saint Germain has concentrated particularly on the scientific field because this is at once the most dangerous area now being plundered by Earthmen and also the area most necessary to the spiritual welfare of man. The ascension process is strictly a scientific one. It is neither mysterious nor mystical. Page 69. Certainly it is not religious. Each and every person must learn, in some embodiment, how to raise the atomic vibration of the four lower bodies. Mental, emotional, etheric and physical. Each and every person must, in some embodiment, discard that disgusting ancient habit of dying and leaving his physical body lying around for someone to bury. In the new age, with the tremendous increase in vibratory rates in and around the planet, the entire emphasis of civilization will be placed on living. The habit of dying will be forgotten as soon as the majority of people have cleaned out their etheric bodies by using the violet fire. The etheric body contains all records, or memories of past lives, back to the very beginning of our individualization as white fire beings. The etheric body is what modern scientists call the subconscious, which is perhaps as good a name as any other, providing its meaning is clearly understood. At the present time, the term is used glibly and in a meaningless manner. That situation will have to be changed because a person with a clogged etheric body can make little evolutionary progress. He must understand clearly that the etheric records of bad habits must be transmuted so that the tiny etheric filaments are clean and firmly woven in a perfect pattern of triangles. Wherever the etheric body registers disease or disharmony of any kind, the tiny filaments become disarranged and tattered. These records of disharmony remain until transmuted. Meanwhile, they are built in, embodiment after embodiment. A striking example of the horrible after-effects of war memories retained by the etheric body is now being illustrated on a worldwide scale. It seemed very noble back in 1940 to train young men to march forth and kill the enemy. Now the bewildered public wonders why we have so much juvenile delinquency. The answer is that many boys who were killed in World War II are back in embodiment, with their etheric memories of violence freshly imprinted on their subtle bodies. The sight of a gun, of a Blood and Thunder TV show or movie, membership in a street gang, or even a family argument is sufficient to stir these etheric records into violent upheavals. Yet the public remains captive to churchianity, militarism and death, resolutely refusing to even investigate the glorious possibilities of living in a clean and wholesome world. In the following chapters are set forth the broad outlines of Saint Germain's New Age program as it has manifested in recent years, and as it will affect the immediate future of every Earth person. Indeed of every Earth atom, since the program is in the final analysis a scientific one, designed to prepare individuals for the ascension process. We will focus our attention first upon the vast preparatory work which was started in 1856 by that great scientific genius, Nikola Tesla. Part 5. The Nikola Tesla Story. Nikola Tesla was not an Earthman. The space people have stated that a male child was born on board a spaceship which was on a flight from Venus to the Earth in July, 1856. The little boy was called Nikola. The ship landed at midnight, between July 9 and 10, in a remote mountain province in what is now Yugoslavia. There, according to arrangements, the child was placed in the care of a good man and his wife, the Reverend Milutin and Duke Tesla. The space people released this information in 1947 to Arthur H. Matthews of Quebec, Canada, an electrical engineer who from boyhood was closely associated with Tesla. In 1944, a year after the death of Tesla, the late John J. O'Neill, then science editor of the New York Herald Tribune, wrote an excellent story of Tesla's life and work, entitled Prodigal Genius. As a reporter, O'Neill frequently interviewed Tesla and had the greatest respect for the Superman. But O'Neill lacked the occult understanding necessary to correctly interpret the extraordinary powers which set Tesla apart from this world. O'Neill made the common error of assuming that Tesla had died as do ordinary mortals, that his work was finished, and that he left no disciples. O'Neill could not have been more mistaken. In the first place, Tesla was not a mortal according to Earth's standards. Being a Venusian, he is now able to work on Earth in his subtle body with far greater facility than when in his physical body. Tesla carefully trained certain disciples to continue his physical plane work under his supervision after he had shed his physical body. He entrusted Arthur H. Matthews of Canada with many tasks, at least two of which are of vital current interest: the Tesla interplanetary communications set and the Tesla anti-war machine. Mr. Matthews built a model Tesla set for interplanetary communications in 1947 and has operated it successfully since. However, he has tuned in only one spaceship thus far, for the set has a limited range. He is now engaged in building a more elaborate set, and will be able to speak more freely of it since he is incorporating many of his own inventive ideas in it. The original design was given to him in confidence by Tesla, and he naturally does not intend to violate that confidence. Mr. Matthews has the complete design for the anti-war machine ready and waiting for any nation which has the courage to use it. Tesla designed the anti-war machine in 1935, but Mr. Matthews has worked on it constantly since, incorporating in it many major improvements. 73. Another disciple who was specially trained by Tesla is Otis T. Carr of Baltimore, Maryland. Carr has recently invented free energy devices capable of powering anything from a hearing aid to a spaceship. Carr was studying art in New York and working in a hotel package room to support himself. Tesla, who was not only completely telepathic but also in touch with the Christ forces on the inner planes, lived in the hotel where Carr was employed. Tesla came straight to his young disciple, asked him to buy 4 pounds of unsalted peanuts and deliver them to his suite. From this beginning, Carr was trained by Tesla over a period of 3 years in almost daily conversations that always started with the peanut delivery. The peanuts were for the New York pigeons, which Tesla so loved. The remarkable achievements of both Matthews and Carr are covered in later chapters of this book. But it may be said here that Tesla is in no sense a disembodied spirit seeking to communicate with disciples and guiding them from the astral plane. Mediums who engage, for profit of course, in receiving messages from the astral plane have tried with vim and with vigor to drum up trade via the spirit or ghost of Tesla. But Tesla is not a ghost, nor did he stand a ghost of a chance of being a ghost. Tesla was an adept, an initiate, a Venusian. He was at all times earth-free. He was never earth-bound. Naturally, Tesla did not go around bragging about these matters. But when he did meet up with a server of the light, Tesla lost no time in engaging in a good talk fist. Both Matthews and Carr have carried out Tesla's work since 1943 without the slightest difficulty. When asked how best to approach the work of Tesla, how to understand his discoveries, both Matthews and Carr have a standard answer. If you wish to understand Tesla, you must attune your mind to God. Tesla and his twin Ray, the white dove who was his constant companion on Earth, are now working in the scientific department of Shambhala, and they do overshadow disciples. But it should be clearly understood that this overshadowing process, when conducted by an initiate, is in no sense related to any type of psychism or mediumship. Every initiate overshadows disciples, otherwise there would be no point in evolution if the higher energies could not in some manner direct lower energies. Every initiate must have disciples in the world of form. Disciples are called upon to operate typewriters, design machinery and do all the other chores of the workaday world. A disciple is an outpost of consciousness for an adept. What, the reader might ask, is the outstanding characteristic which distinguishes a Tesla disciple? In every case, a Tesla disciple is, consciously or unconsciously, affiliated with one or more of the Masters of Wisdom, and is a student in a master's ashram, although this fact may be known only on the inner planes. Every Tesla disciple is working with the energies from at least 5 cosmic rays, and is usually unconscious of his correct ray status, as knowledge of this kind can easily become a source of pride and therefore a handicap. Every Tesla disciple extends the hand of friendship to our interplanetary neighbors. Every Tesla disciple is already firmly oriented in the new age and has unbounded enthusiasm for a free and joyous world. Many persons who worked for Tesla, or who were associated with him closely, as was John J. O'Neill, have expressed disappointment that Tesla did not leave a heritage of great scientific secrets which could be explored, and, of course, exploited. But, Tesla, the Venusian, had no secrets. Only Earth people are greedy enough and stupid enough to have secrets. The Venusians, Martians, and visitors from other planets who fly through the Earth's atmosphere daily, have no secrets either. They have a message: love ye one another. But Earth people have successfully ignored that message for at least 2,000 years, and they might go right on ignoring it save for New Age developments based on application of universal law. Such application was the clue to all of Tesla's achievements. He was a discoverer, not a mere inventor. There seem to be no records of Tesla revealing his identity as a Venusian during his Earth life. But when the announcement of this fact was made to Mr. Matthews by the space people, it did not come as a surprise in most quarters, because by then it was generally known that at least 10 million people from other planets had been infiltrated into the Earth's population. It had long been known that most of the Masters of Wisdom, down through the centuries, were volunteers from other worlds. But it seemed doubtful, for a time, that Tesla himself had been personally aware of his origin during his physical plane life on Earth. However, It now appears that he did understand his mission, which was actually to prepare the planet Earth for the space age. The fact that he told Otis Tika so much about other planets indicates that he was quite familiar with the subject. He frankly told Carr that he, Carr, was destined to explore space. Tesla also gave Mr. Matthews the design for the interplanetary communications set in 1938, another clear indication that Tesla knew that other planets were inhabited, and he obviously knew they possessed spaceships. He told Mr. Matthews that the set should be built in a few years, after 1938, at which time spaceships from other worlds would approach the Earth. Tesla never married, and never had any romantic attachments or even close friendships with either men or women, except in certain cases where the bond was one of discipleship or where some useful purpose would be served for the benefit of humanity. Tesla not only lived alone in hotels, but he lived behind locked doors. Only occasionally was a maid permitted to enter his room to clean it. However, Otis Tika, over a period of 3 years, was his daily visitor, and Tesla explained to Carr that visitors were not normally allowed because, coming into his suite from the harsh, outside world, they immediately lowered the vibrations in the rooms in which Tesla had to live and work and commune with his creator. Mr. Carr has explained that often, when he came to Tesla's suite, bringing the 4 pounds of unsalted peanuts, Tesla would ask him to just sit down and relax for an hour or more. Not a word would be spoken between the two men. Yet when Carr rose to leave, he would feel refreshed and inspired. The vibrations in the room had done the necessary work, attuning and purifying his four lower bodies. Tesla had another trusted friend in the person of Boris Dutanko, a New York publisher. Mr. Dutanko has related how, Saturday after Saturday, he used to meet Tesla for luncheon at the old Hotel Brevoort on Lower Fifth Avenue, a place famous for its fine French cuisine. Mr. Dutanko always found these luncheon visits highly inspiring, though unusual in some respects. He said that often the two of them sat together at the table in complete silence for well over an hour. Finally Tesla would speak, and then the illuminating conversation would flow like molten gold. Both Mr. Matthews and Mr. Carr received from Tesla a great deal of confidential information about future world conditions and developments concerning the emergence of the New Age civilization. Most of this information had to do with spaceships, space people, and interplanetary communications. When Tesla shed his physical body in 1943, it was apparent that he was leaving the physical plane of manifest appearances to enter into more subtle vibrations, vibrations which were invisible to the average man. These vibrations were not invisible to Tesla. He was completely clairvoyant, clairaudient and telepathic, as is any adept. Again, it must be stressed that this type of clarity has nothing whatever to do with mediumship or psychism. The latter belongs to the animal kingdom. Tesla was never really at home on the physical plane, dealing with matter in its harshest state. In the subtle worlds he was completely free. Yet for 87 of the most difficult years ever visited upon this planet, Tesla carried on his work like the great gentleman he was. In retrospect, the pattern of his physical sojourn in the world of form, which seems so complex to writers like John J. O'Neill, emerges in simple clarity. Tesla had obviously agreed to come to the Earth as a volunteer worker to assist in launching the New Age, which he knew to be synonymous with the Space Age. It is perfectly apparent that Ascended Master Saint Germain had to bring in people from other planets, people with knowledge of outer space conditions, to handle the major aspects of the planned program. Tesla was designated to work on the third ray of love in action, for that is the ray which supplies our atmosphere with electricity. The first three major rays form the three aspects of God, as defined by major religions. The four minor rays provide what we recognize as God's attributes. Christianity correctly defines the first three rays as a trinity, representing the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. The first or Father aspect is derived from the ray of power and purpose. The second, the Son aspect, is the ray of illumination and wisdom leading to intelligent love in action, or the third ray. Originally, we were all sons of God, or sparks from the great central sun of the galaxy. From the strictly scientific point of view, the first three rays provide life, light, and electricity to this planet. The fourth ray of purity leads man through conflict to harmony. The fifth ray is that of concrete science and knowledge and provides the world of form with an understandable functional basis. The sixth ray energizes all of man's ideals and ideologies, whether wise or foolish. During the Piscean Age, it led to the rise of Christianity and churchianity, and to all sorts of experimental economic and political systems. Then follows the seventh ray, now in manifestation, the ray which is now being called into action to transmute and release mankind from all past errors accumulated during 19 million years of struggle since the laggards came. At the present time, and for centuries past, all individuals who desired so-called occult knowledge have been regularly taken into the various ray temples or retreats for training at night, while the physical body lies sleeping. The temples are open 24 hours a day round the globe, so their facilities are always available to students. It should not be considered that this training is mystical. It is strictly utilitarian and practical and is designed to make physical plane living easier and more wholesome. It is designed to lead not to death, but to the ascension for each individual. Page 79. For example, every great musical composer down through the ages has been a temple student. Some composers are able to bring through their memories with greater accuracy than others. Wagner was an outstanding student in the music temple, and during his waking hours he was able to bring through musical notations with scarcely a deviation from the original temple teachings. The story of Lohengrin is one of his finest examples. It is presumed that Tesla not only had the usual free access to the temples during his sleeping hours, but that he also had direct communication while in full waking consciousness. This is not unusual for even an advanced student. It is the normal practice for initiates. In the outer world, there is no information available on Tesla's exact evolutionary status on Venus, but it is known that the entire Venusian race is considered adept from our point of view. However, when space people take Earth bodies, they are often mercifully granted certain mental blockages for their own protection. That is, if a Venusian had a full and complete memory of his life on Venus, he would find it well nigh impossible to cope daily with Earth's situations. Even the initiate Jesus did not have a complete mental grasp of his true mission until he was more than 12 years of age. It was then that he was taken to India for personal training under the supervision of his great teacher, the Christ, known in the outworld as Lord Maitreya. John J. O'Neill has written a most detailed story of Tesla's life and scientific work in Prodigal Genius. But for those readers who are just becoming oriented in this field of study, it might be well to pause here for a brief review of the highlights that lighted the path of the man who came to Earth to bring electricity to our homes and factories and illumination to our darkened minds. Historians agree that Nikola Tesla was born at midnight, between July 9th and 10th, in the year of 1856. Nikola himself hinted on a few occasions that this was not the date of his birth. These hints were disregarded along with hundreds of other statements made by Tesla, because in most quarters, he was regarded as being a bit impractical. This was not a criticism, for his genius was so highly respected that it was generally conceded that he did not have to measure up to conventional standards. He was to be allowed his little eccentricities, his passing fancies. The space people have now stated that Nikola was born on board their ship on a flight from Venus, and that they landed on the Earth at midnight, between July 9th and 10th, 1856. When the space people say that Nikola was born on board one of their ships, they do not mean that it was a physical birth. Physical conception and the birthing processes known on this planet are not used elsewhere. A sex system was introduced here after the laggards came, in order to keep the race in manifestation, and to provide for re-embodiment in groups bound by karma. This allowed karmic debts to be paid off in kind under the old law of an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. On other planets, positive and negative light rays are used to produce a physical form which can be occupied by an evolving life stream. The form is a full stature. It is only on this planet that tiny, baby forms are utilized. Giulia Tesla, the Earth mother who cared for Niccolo with a rare tenderness, was a most remarkable woman and assuredly possessed advanced spiritual powers. It has been said that she, too, was a Venusian, and if this is true, it accounts for her very unusual abilities. She was the eldest child in a family of 7 children. Her father was a minister of the Serbian Orthodox Church. Her mother had become blind after the 7th child was born, and Giulia unhesitatingly took charge of the entire household. She never attended school, nor did she learn even the rudiments of reading and writing at home. Yet she moved with ease in cultured circles, as did her family. Here was a woman who could neither read nor write, yet she possessed literary abilities far beyond those of a person of considerable education. Tesla, himself, never wearied of talking about his remarkable mother, and described how she had absorbed by ear all the cultural riches of her community and her nation. Like Nicola, she apparently had the power of instant recall. Nicola said that she could easily recite, without error, long passages from the Bible. She could repeat thousands of verses of the national poetry of her country. It was because of her great interest in poetry that Nicola, in his busy American days as a superman, still found time to translate and have published some of the best examples of Serbian sagas. His mother was also famed throughout her home provinces for her artistic ability, often expressed in beautiful needlework. She possessed remarkable manual dexterity, and Nicola said her fingers were so sensitive that she could tie 3 knots in an eyelash. Even when she was past 60 years of age, she had an excellent grasp of philosophy and apparently a practical understanding of mechanical and technical devices. She needed a loom for household weaving, so she designed and built one. She did not think of herself as an inventor, yet she built many labor-saving devices and instruments for her household. In addition, she was so skillful in handling business and financial matters that she managed all accounts for her household as well as for her husband's church. Nicola's Earth father was the son of an army officer, and as a young man set out on a military career. But he was soon disillusioned, for he was irked by the discipline, and turned to his true calling in the literary field. He wrote poetry, articles on current problems, and philosophical essays. This led, quite naturally, to the ministry, giving him an opportunity to write sermons and to speak from the pulpit. He did not limit himself to the usual church topics, but ranged far and wide, covering subjects of local and national interest concerning labor, social and economic problems. Until Nicola was 7 years of age, the father had a parish church at Smiljan, an agricultural community in a high plateau region in that part of the Alps which stretch from Switzerland to Greece. This then was the childhood environment of the boy from Venus. It was a life filled with joy. He had an ideal home with a loving, understanding family. He lived in a magnificent countryside, close to nature. He was a boy like other little boys up to a certain point, the point at which he became the Superboy, foreshadowing the Superman. And so it was that he lacked human companions, a state, not of loneliness but of aloneness, that was to continue throughout his physical incarnation. The unlighted ones whom he met everywhere through the years felt sorry for him because they assumed he was lonely. Tesla never tried to explain his position, for he knew he would meet with no understanding from an alien world. To the end of his time in a physical body, he lived at the very center, the very core, of a magnificent solitude, listening always to the voice of the silence. As a boy, Nicola liked nothing better than to wander in the woods and over the mountains near his home. His little friends did not understand or share his boundless enthusiasm for trees, streams, birds and their nests, sunshine, clouds and stormy skies. Nor did they enjoy what they considered the hard work connected with Nicola's many boyhood inventions. He was constantly engaged in experiments that often failed, a fact which made them all the more fascinating. In reviewing his life in later years, he could look back upon these many lines of investigation which he had started as a boy and see how they led directly to some of his major inventions. As he grew to maturity, he displayed certain characteristics which might have revealed his Venusian origin had they been understood. His hands were unusually long, particularly his thumbs, and were extremely sensitive, carrying strong clean etheric currents.